Hey, Sarum. Thanks for agreeing to come on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Happy to be here.
I want to get a little bit of insight on how did you get into software development and what was your journey?
I've been playing with computers since I was a little kid. So, I mean, back in the 80s when I had Commodore 64, right? And so I kind of knew right very early on that I wanted to get into computers some one way or the other. So I did software engineering at UCLA in 1991, and I graduated in 96. And kind of through that process, worked at Symantec as an intern. And that was, really, really amazing being, surrounded by people doing this for a living. And it was fun, right? It was really awesome just kind of being part of that problem-solving process, producing stuff for customers that they loved. And then I was hooked, right? So I was pretty lucky early on also to get a position at Microsoft. And it was a startup that got acquired by Microsoft. And that I got such great mentorship. And so I was, again, super, super fortunate early on in my career to be, working on really cool products and with really, really talented people. So that's kind of how I got into software development, is just working at companies early on that really guided my path into like professionally, strong practices, which is just kind of what I've been continuing to do.
Did you always want to be in management, or was that something that maybe, I don't know, there was a vacuum of leadership and you stepped into it, or did you always think you were going to end up being a manager?
No, I mean, I think like a lot of engineers early on in their career, I didn't want to be in management. I think I was like everyone else who was, enjoying the challenge of solving problems. And, I loved hacking. I loved just, doing coding. But the so, having gone through Microsoft and Symantec, some pretty large actual software development houses, led me to a job that was, not it, it was, at a finance org, and they were, they didn't have very strong software development practices and processes. And so, at that level, at my career as a kind of senior software engineer, I started establishing processes and then, putting some structure in place around how to do software development properly from my experience in doing it at those companies. And they kind of recognized, oh, I think you'd be better off like leading this team rather than just contributing. And so the more I led the team, the more responsibilities I took on as a manager, and then I took on people management responsibilities. And from that point forward, I realized that that was an aspect of the job that I really loved, just talking to people, working with people, helping guide their careers, helping guide their development. So that's what I've been doing ever since.
Awesome. How difficult did you find the people management side of it? Like, did that come natural to you? Did you have to do a lot of training to kind of pick up that side of it?
I wish I had done more training. I wish I'd had more training. And I think subsequently in, some positions I've been in, I've gotten some of that training, and I'm really appreciative for it of it. But no, I didn't have a lot of training. I think for me, I love working with people. I love talking to people, and I work across teams really, really easily. And so I think that really helped me. That helped, guide me. And I had really great managers, so I had good role models. So people who asked me all the questions that I wanted to, be asked as a software engineer, I started to learn to ask those questions as a manager, and that's kind of how I just kind of naturally developed into it. And subsequently, obviously, like once you actually decide this is your career path, I read books. I just like consumed as much as I could about how to do this well. I don't know that I'm the best. I wouldn't say I'm fantastic at it. I think I still have a lot to learn. But I think at least a metric that I use for myself is, are there people that I've worked with in the past who I would like to work with again, and who would work with me again? And are there people who've worked for me and would work for me again? And I've had experiences where I've left companies and people who I used to work with and used to work for me would reach out and say, let's work together again. And so that for me, it's a good, I think a good sign, I hope.
Yes, that's true. Like you do learn. I find myself same way. Like you look at the managers you've had and the I guess the various coworkers you've had, and you learn what you didn't like and how you didn't like to be treated or how you like to be treated, and that ends up becoming, I guess, forming who you become as a manager down the road. It's interesting you said about training, because one of the areas that, you know, you and I have talked about where a lot of managers lack training is the hiring process and how to, you know, actually having a process for hiring rather than just doing it haphazard. And I just want to kind of, I guess, get your take on what is your philosophy for how you hire, you know, what processes do you use?
Yeah, I think I'm very, very fortunate to have come out of the Amazon school of hiring and making great hiring decisions very recently, right, where we worked together. And prior to that, I was, you know, very much doing the haphazard, you know, method of, you know, pulling together people and saying, let's go talk to this one candidate. And each of us would talk to them individually and then get together in a room and talk about what we, you know, discussed and make a decision. And that's kind of how it was at a lot of places that I'd worked prior to Amazon. And at Amazon, the structure is much more strict. It's a lot more specific what each person in the interview loop is doing. And so kind of since then, I've really taken that with me. And in my current role, I've kind of trained other people, trained other managers, trained other people who are in the hiring loops how to do it kind of the Amazon way, because it works. It works really, really well. I think it's a lot more objective. It's a lot more data driven in terms of hiring practices than the haphazard. Let's just have a conversation and talk through, you know, whatever is on my mind right now. And then try to make a decision based on that. So my philosophy is largely driven by what Amazon does, which is gets data, right? Gets a sense of, you know, very specific things in a person's background and experience that points to their you know, behavior as a leader, which is what Amazon tries to do, is hire leaders, and their competency as a technical contributor. Whether an individual contributor or a manager.
And when you mentioned about getting data points, I think you and I kind of understand that, but how do you, I guess, for a person who hasn't had that experience of being kind of going through a culture that has the hiring process in place, how do you explain to them, you know, how does data go beyond just what's on the resume, right? Because I think a lot of people, I mean, myself included, when I did hiring before, I would look at a resume and like, all right, let me ask a couple of questions about what their experience was. And I guess that was my data point. But can you elaborate when you mentioned data point, what are you talking about specifically?
Yeah. The way that Amazon goes about hiring and the way that I do it now is specifically around experiences that someone had in a situation that's going to lead me to be able to understand how they would behave in a similar situation if they were on my team. So the Amazon questions typically start with, tell me about a time, right? What was a time where there was a coworker, a colleague on your team who was struggling and, you know, you stepped in to help them? Like, what did you do? What was the situation? What was going on? How did you help them? And that kind of leads you to be able to make a judgment call about, you know, is this someone going to be a strong team player? Is this someone who's going to be a strong mentor if they're, you know, a candidate for senior engineer? And you want to, you know, you want to be able to probe into that situation as deeply as possible to understand, like, you know, did they simply do the other person's work for them? Did they, you know, do over the shoulder code reviews? Like, what was happening and how did they approach helping this colleague in situations where there's a problem in production, right? You want to talk to an engineering candidate and get a sense that the decisions they've made in that kind of situation are focused on mitigating impact on customers and not, you know, trying to root cause what the underlying bug is while the customer is actually actively suffering. So those are the kinds of questions that I'm going to ask is, you know, tell me about a time where a customer was impacted by a bug. What did you do? What was the bug? What was happening? You know, let's dive into, you know, details about what your actual actions were. And so those are the things that I'm trying to glean out specifically what they did and how they were what they were focused on when they were doing that investigation. So, you know, for, I think generally speaking, putting Amazon aside for a second, what hiring managers tend to look for are kind of three distinct things. The first one is competency, right? So any interview loop, you're really looking for, you know, does this person have the chops to contribute and succeed here in this role? And that means if it's a software engineering position for a backend team that's doing, you know, cloud services engineering, you're going to look for someone who's strong in containers, who's strong in, you know, databases, who's strong in APIs, like whatever it is. Maybe it's your specific cloud provider. Maybe you're all in on AWS, so you want to know someone who's strong in, you know, EKS or ECS or whatever it is that you use. But also, you know, if they aren't, you know, you want to be able to say, you know, they worked in, you know, Azure, but that translates, right? They understand the same concepts, even in a different cloud. But still get into the details of what they did, you know, in their role. And does their experience map to what I'm going to expect for them to do for me? And then, you know, same thing for coding questions, right? You want to be able to say, you know, here's an example of a situation. And, you know, can you talk through what kind of data structures you would use? Can you talk through, you know, algorithm complexity? And they should have prepared enough for the interview that they can answer those questions specifically and you know, be able to work through a coding question and come up with a working answer. So they don't have any, you know, the hiring manager doesn't have any concerns around that person's ability to contribute technically. If there's any, you know, question or doubt, and overall the interview loop is, you know, either mixed or negative about the competency question, it's a no hire, right? Generally speaking, like, you know, you want to have a balanced interview, and you want to be able to say, you know, I'm looking for both, you know, competency as well as culture fit. Is it someone we'd love to have on the team? Is it someone that's going to, you know, get along well with everyone? And someone who's motivated to succeed here. So you want to look at all three of those things. But if the competency question isn't answered in a very strong way, generally, like, the other two don't really matter. But, you know, once the competency question is answered, they're capable of doing this job at the level that you expect them to do it at. Then the other two questions kind of come into play, which is, are they motivated, right? Are they going to stick around? Are they going to be, you know, a strong contributor who is looking to get into the type of work that you're doing here? Or is this, you know, kind of a temporary stepping stone onto something else? Is this something that, you know, they're only going to be half-heartedly working on? Because in the interview, it came across that they really were interested in some other technology, right? My current role, we don't do a lot of machine learning, not right now anyway. And or, you know, front-end development. And if someone came in and said, you know, I really love doing, you know, front-end development, or I really love doing mobile development, I'd say, that's awesome. You know, we have a team over here that's doing mobile development. We have a team over here that's doing front-end development. And I'd love to let them talk to you if that's your passion. But that's not what my team does. And I'd have concerns about interviewing you for my team because, you know, you're not that interested in back-end development, which is what my team does. So I want to make sure that they're motivated to come in and stick around and get deep into the services that I'm building, that my team is building. And if that lines up well, and if their competency, you know, checks out, then you get into the kind of culture fit questions, which are, you know, let's talk about situations that you've been in, right? Are they customer focused in their decision making? Are they, you know, team focused? Are they, you know, someone who doesn't say things like, that's not my job, right? I love the Amazon ownership principle. That's a fantastic principle, and it works really, really well when you put a team together and you see, you know, someone else having an issue. Like, the ownership principle speaks really well for people who can jump in and say, you know, I didn't create this problem, but I'm taking responsibility for seeing that it gets fixed. And that's exactly what successful teams have, is a lot of owners who feel really strongly about the service that they're working on. So, you know, once you've kind of, as a hiring manager, established that this is a great candidate from a technical competency point of view, and they're a strong culture fit, and they're a strong, you know, motivation, they have strong motivation to be here and to contribute. That's kind of when, for me, all the boxes are checked, and I can go talk to the other people on the team and, you know, make a decision.
You mentioned competency. How do you go about kind of setting a bar or a level that fits the role you're looking for? More specifically, I found, like, a lot of times you know, people want to either, like, people already give very softball questions where, you know, it's like, you know, what's the internet and, you know, some basic thing like that. Or I've seen the opposite where it's almost like a solving a complex riddle like you know you would do in like a high school math exam. And I found neither one of those things effective. What is your theory, or what is your kind of philosophy around finding a good technical question, you know, whether it's coding or whether it's architecture, depending on the competency of the role?
Yeah. I kind of take the approach of starting with, you know, I mean, there's tons and tons of example questions online. So, everyone at this point knows LeetCode. Code. Everyone knows that if you're interviewing at you know, any of the big companies, they're going to be using some LeetCode question for the coding. There's just no getting around that at this point. So I think the first thing to do is just kind of look at those questions and understand kind of broadly the various algorithms that are probably going to come into question, the various data structures that you're going to be asked about. Complexity is definitely something you're going to be asked about, and just be flexible, right? Just be ready to like kind of apply knowledge on, you know, on these different things to whatever question you get asked. For me, you know, I don't do a lot of coding day to day, but I have to stay on top of these things, right? So I am able to ask, you know, questions that are, you know, broadly, for me, more about, you know, do you understand data structures and complexity pretty well? Do you know to pick a hash when you need to use a hash versus a linked list or whatever? And for more often when I'm interviewing senior candidates and I'm talking through system design, the things I'm looking for are, you know, do they understand scaling? Do they understand scaling problems, right? Do they understand to, you know, have the right kinds of, you know, region failover and load balancing and, you know, systems in place to handle whatever the situation might be. And so we'll talk through a lot of those things. You know, let's talk about setting up, you know, mechanisms to make this stuff automatic. For, you know, DevOps roles, I want to make sure that someone understands CI, right? I want to make sure that someone understands automatic rollbacks, right? And your pipelines. So those are the kinds of things that if someone isn't familiar with, at a particular level that I'm looking for, especially at a senior level, then that's kind of a problem, right? And it's not the case that they wouldn't get hired if they don't understand those things, but it is the case that I'd probably want to bring them in at a lower level, because that's just something you need to understand really, really well inside and out before you're coming in as a senior. I mean technical questions, you could, it doesn't benefit you as a hiring manager to throw anything out that's a softball. You want to throw something out that's pretty difficult, that's tough, but possible to do in, you know, in an hour, 45 minutes, for a strong candidate. I think the rubric that generally works well is if in a debrief everyone's not pretty excited about the candidate, it's not a hire. Like you want the team to feel pretty strong about, This is going to be someone who comes in here and contributes and really like raises the bar. If it's a lukewarm kind of conversation about the candidate, it tends to be like, no, this is probably not someone we want. There's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of candidates out there. So let's keep looking. That's on the technical side. On the you know, interpersonal side, you want to make sure that you're talking about emotional intelligence and, you know, collaborativeness and someone who's capable of communicating really, really well, right? And if they are, and they've got a lot of energy, and this is kind of a key for interview and for candidates, you know, that speaks well to someone that you're going to want to work with, you're going to want to hang out with, you're going to want to, you know, get lunch with, and that all builds to a strong working relationship, right? If it's someone that comes across as abrasive and, you know, talks, you know, kind of in a negative way about previous coworkers, it's not someone you're going to want to work with. You know, I've had to interview people, or I've interviewed people who just really put down their previous coworkers, and that, you know, doesn't make you look better. It makes you look worse. So I always want to like say like, hey, that's nice, but you know, I'd really want someone who's going to come in here and lift the team up, and then, you know, speak well about the people they work with. So. Yeah, you want to hire great people that you want to work with, that you want to hang out with.
How do you make sure that stays neutral and doesn't turn into kind of, you know, he came out of a meeting. I had a gut feeling. He seems like a fun guy to hang out with, and maybe at a detriment of a potential really good candidate who maybe at first glance, you know, is not someone you don't necessarily want to grab a drink with, but, you know, you might be inadvertently, I guess, I don't know, discriminating is not the right word, but I will say that's a little bit discriminating. Like if you don't want to discriminate against somebody who's maybe quieter, just because they don't have that social aspect. So what is the, I guess, the data points you look for to keep that objective?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the data points I look for in terms of kind of energy level and culture fit are about communication, right? Really, it comes down to the questions, you know, tell me about a time where you have to communicate, you know, a tough message to a customer or a tough message to, you know, someone in leadership. You know, what did you do? How did you communicate that? A tough message to a colleague or, you know, you had to deal with a tough, you know, interpersonal situation. And these are times when those interesting stories come out, right? The interview in general is a storytelling effort, right? It's a game of, you know, someone who comes in and has some set of experience, and you as the interviewer want to dive into a particular story and get the details about that story. So for me, the stories I look for are stories where someone really raised the bar in terms of behavior, right? So they came in, they took ownership of a problem that a customer was having, they delivered something that the customer, you know, loved, they helped out a colleague, they told leadership, you know, we're having this problem and here's the solution that I'm suggesting we take. You know, whatever it happens to be, it will come across as a data point that's, you know, related to some communication issue. And that's kind of how I think I avoid bias. Bias is tough. Bias is a tough question when it comes to interviewing. I think there's an article I read about, you know, evaluating humans is really, really hard and humans are terrible at it, which I think is true, right? I think everybody who comes into an interview, both on the candidate side and on the interviewer side, is biased in some way, will have some bias, you know, that they bring into the interview room. So, you know, really like the good interviewers focus on getting data points, right? They focus on, you know, figuring out a situation that the candidate was in the past, really understanding, you know, what they did deeply and specifically, probing that, right? Probing that they actually know what they're talking about, right? You don't just let it go because people will say, oh, I did this. And, you know, maybe they're taking credit for something someone else did. So you should be able to probe that they actually did it. I did some work on video encoding early on in my career. And, you know, I haven't had to hire for that kind of a role. But when someone came in and told me that, you know, a problem that they solved was related to video encoding, I got nerdy about it. I started asking them specific questions about, like, well, you know, tell me about the containers. Tell me about, you know, how you did this encoding. Tell me about what you used. And they were able to talk through it in a pretty, you know, sufficient level of detail that made me convinced, yeah, okay, they actually did this work. So, you know, I think the way I approach it is, if I can get, you know, solid data that avoids bias, I can be objective. The thing you want to do as a candidate, if you can, and especially after you've gotten the job, is to really, you know, knock it out of the park early and kind of establish this. There's an unconscious bias effect called the Horn's halo effect. And essentially what that is an early unconscious judgment that someone will make about you tends to last. It tends to be the lasting judgment despite other evidence subsequent. So if someone has a particularly negative view of something that you did early on in establishing the relationship, that negative impression tends to last, right? And likewise, a positive impression tends to last despite any, you know, subsequent negative things. So if you come in and early on in the interview really establish, you know, an outstanding answer, and you know, just bring a ton of energy to it, I think that will kind of countervail, you know, subsequent struggles and stumbles. And when you start a new job and you just really knock it out of the park early, you know, later on down the line, you'll be forgiven for mistakes that you made. And I've seen that happen and it works. It's an unfortunate bias, but I think it can be used to your advantage if you really knock it out of the park early.
So you mentioned, like, you know, you've gone to companies that don't have that hiring process. As a manager who might be listening, who maybe works in a company that does things haphazardly or doesn't have systems, what are some ways you would recommend going about changing things, at least for your own candidates that you're hiring and interviewing? And perhaps how do you influence the broader culture?
Yeah, I encourage the teams that are on my my interview loops now to do a pre-brief, right? To talk about what we're going to talk about right before the candidate comes in. And that means, you know, really kind of going around and saying, you know, what questions are going to ask, what areas are going to focus on, and making sure that there's an overlap, right? So if I'm focused on, you know, questions surrounding, you know, customer obsession, I don't want other people to be asking those same kind of questions. I'd rather them focus on something like bias for action or, you know, diving deep. I still use Amazon leadership principles in my interviews, even though I'm not at Amazon anymore, because they work. They work.
Really, I was gonna say, those all sound familiar.
Yeah. They work super well to describe what it is that generally people look for in candidates, right? I look for someone who doesn't say that's not my job, and that's the ownership principle, right? That's exactly what you want to see when you're talking to someone. So before the interview, you go around and establish who's going to be in the interview loop and what kind of questions they're going to ask. You know, if it's a technical interview, who's going to ask the data structures question? Who's going to ask the algorithms question? You kind of, you know, vet those questions and make sure they're, you know, solvable in 45 minutes or so. And that they're scalable, right? So this comes to your earlier question about leveling. You don't want to throw softball questions out and make it super easy coding questions. But for the, you know, really talented engineers who might be able to level up, you want to be able to, you know, stretch them, right? So if your question can be expanded, right, have an opportunity in the interview itself to say, wow, you got that really quick. Let's talk about, you know, a more, you know, extensive application of this algorithm, and go to some more, you know, tricky line of questioning there. So, you know, that's the first thing, is just getting everyone on the same page about what you're going to talk about in the interview. The thing I encourage people to do is try not to prejudge, right? Try not to get in there and in the middle of the conversation, you know, just check out, right? Just don't just say, oh, you know, I think I know I'm not going to be inclined on this candidate and stop, you know, making an effort, right? You want to give the candidate a fantastic experience no matter what, right? They should have a good experience. And maybe they happen to be struggling with your specific interview for whatever reason. I'd say no matter what, just give them the benefit of the doubt throughout the entire hour that you're going to spend with them. Be on their side, right? Generally speaking, you want to be collaborative in coding questions. You don't want to like throw something over the wall and just sit back with your arms folded and wait for them to, you know, struggle through an answer. You want to try to like help them through, you know, the edge cases and, you know, the error conditions and whatever it is that they might run into, so that they get to a good answer. And at the end of the day, like the debrief is the time that you make the judgment call, right? It's not in the middle of the interview. So the thing I tell people is, you know, if you're talking to a candidate, just take notes, right? Just try to get the data, just try to get the information down as much as you can, and be able to come into the debrief with detailed notes, right? With a detailed write-up. This is another thing that I learned at Amazon, right? You want to go into the debrief with something written, and then before you start talking, have everyone go, you know, pass their notes around and talk and read through what other people, you know, saw in the candidate before you start talking about them, because that way your judgment isn't biased by someone else's, you know, words, right? Your judgment about the candidate isn't biased about the first person who talked in the debrief. So, you know, we don't have strong tooling around this, you know, in my current role. So we just use a Slack channel, right? We open a new Slack thread and everyone just replies to it, you know, 5 minutes before the meeting with their summary about their experience with the candidate, their raw notes, and their judgment, right? I'm inclined to hire this person. I'm not inclined to hire this person, whatever it is. And then we talk about it, right? So after, you know, you paste in your notes, everybody gets on a call, everybody reads everybody else's notes. And then, you know, we have a conversation about whether this person would be a good fit for the team or not. So those are the things that I definitely took from Amazon. And I think they work really, really well. And I think they've put the right structure in place, to make those kinds of decisions as objectively as possible. Like I said, it's tough to judge other humans, but you know, you try to do it with data now, right? I try to do it with data as much as I can.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the debrief? Because I know you mentioned, like, you know, if you had a rock star candidate and they came in, everybody's inclined, or the opposite, where, you know, somebody didn't do well that day on the interview. What do you do with the mixed kind of candidates where, you know, like you mentioned, the way you're doing it is you kind of do this, raw notes, you know, people's opinions before, so then you're not influencing. But, you know, if you got kind of a split decision, what is your process around kind of coming to a conclusion either way to hire or not to hire?
Yeah, those are always the tough questions. At Amazon, I was a bar raiser, and the thing that I would always come to the hiring manager with, ultimately, it's always the hiring manager's decision, right? Ultimately, like, the hiring manager is the one who's going to be responsible for this person's, you know, career growth, this person's performance, you know. So if you know, everyone else in the loop is strongly inclined, including, you know, the bar raiser, and the hiring manager's just like, I'm not seeing it, I don't feel like taking this risk, then that person's not going to get hired. Unfortunately, I think that's just the reality of the situation. But I think it's the right thing. That's the right balance. It's not a democracy, right? It tends to be like, you know, some people think, oh, my vote counts just as much as everyone else's vote. No, right? The hiring manager's vote counts because they're the ones who are responsible for that person once they're on the team. But I think the way debriefs that are split tend to shake out is, or at least the way that I would push them to shake out as bar raiser and now as a hiring manager, is, you know, everyone needs to kind of make that final call. Is this person gonna raise the bar? Is this person gonna come in here and be a strong enough player that they're leveling us up, right? That's what I want to see. If people can't come to a consensus about that in a positive way, then it's a no hire. Right? I think at the end of the day, if you're so split and everyone's on the fence, and it's just not possible to get to consensus about that, it, you know, just say no, right? You're taking a risk and it's not worth it. If you can get to consensus that this person will raise the bar, this person will level us up as an organization, that's all you need. As a hiring manager, if you agree and you get the feedback from everyone who's been in the room with that candidate, then that's the decision that you need to make. I think it's never the case. It's rarely been the case that, you see a candidate who fires on all cylinders, right? There's always going to be some concern. You know, that's, humans are not, there's no perfect human, right? That's not possible. So you're going to find a candidate who comes in who's, you know, really strong in one area, but clearly has some growth, you know, to do in another area. That's okay, right? That's fine. I think you call that out in the debrief. You say, hey, you know, they have this concerning data point. Let's talk about it. Is that concerning enough that we're going to say that's a deal breaker? If it's a technical issue and enough people have that same issue, enough people say, yeah, they didn't answer my coding question either, they couldn't come up with a working solution, and, you know, despite a lot of help, despite a lot of hints, then I think it doesn't matter how nice of a person they were. It doesn't matter how great they answered the leadership and culture fit questions. You can't take that risk. It's too much, because at the end of the day, especially for mid-level and senior engineers, your job is not to train them in software engineering, right? Your job is to, you know, bring them in and get them up to speed on your specific stack. And then they need to be, you know, self-starters. They need to be self-driven and self-motivated. For people out of college, right, for university hires, it's a little bit different. You don't expect them to have that level of experience, and it's okay, right? If they don't have, you know, enough actual practical experience to do the job that you want them to do, they're going to need to get trained, and that's expected. But they should still be strong enough in the, you know, theoretical coding questions that you're going to throw at them to not raise concerns about, you know, could this person code their way out of a paper bag? Because I've seen that, right? I've seen people who've, you know, been coding for many, many years, ostensibly, you know, come into an interview and say, well, I'm a senior engineer. Like, okay, let's work through this problem. And they can't even get a line of code on the whiteboard. So that's kind of, you know, if you're a junior engineer, just, you know, show me that you understand the fundamentals, show me that you can work through, you know, a problem and apply the right data structure to that problem. And, you know, the rest you'll learn on the job.
What do you say to the hiring manager who says, you know what, I'm not in Google, Facebook, Amazon, right? I can't be that picky. And perhaps, you know, I may need to settle for someone who doesn't quote unquote raise the bar. What do you say to that manager?
You're making a really expensive decision. You know, you're consciously, I don't want to speak this way about human beings, but you know, you're consciously buying a lemon, right? You're consciously saying, I'm going to get this car that I know isn't the best car, but hopefully it'll get me from point A to point B. And there's indications that it won't. There's indications that it's not going to get you from point A to point B, but you're buying it anyway. So I think the thing to do is, in that situation, you know, hold to your guns, right? Stick to your guns. And then, you know, you don't have the budget to get someone that Amazon does, right? That's probably the most common situation you'll find when managers say something like that. But that's not to say that you can't find really strong candidates who are still early in their career and could still produce, you know, strong results for you. And, you know, you can afford them. I think that's still possible in most companies.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I find that a lot of times out of desperation, people are just wanting to fill in a seat. And that ends up becoming very expensive, like you were saying, expensive costs where, you know, they don't work out. They might be a drag on your actual team. And sometimes it's the better solution just to keep that position empty and maybe beat down a headcount than to try to fill it with fill the seat with a warm body.
Right. The costs, right? The interviewing costs are incredibly high, right? You know, on the order of probably close to $10,000, right? At this point, if you think about the time that recruiters spend, the time that HR spends, hiring manager spends a solid, you know, a couple hours per interview, right? And then everyone on your team has to spend time, and all of that time is worth money. So at the end of the day, you're spending, you know, thousands of dollars just to evaluate someone. So you would hope that they do well, right? Before they come in, right? Just at the resume screen, at the phone screen, you want to get a good enough sense that this is someone who could pass our bar, who could pass our interview, and then pull them in and put them through the process. If you don't have a strong inclination early on, you shouldn't bring them in for a full interview because it's expensive. And once they're there, right, if you're not strongly convinced that they're going to be a good performer, you know, their cost is going to be, you know, their work quality and the delayed output and the impact on morale, all of that stuff has a financial impact as well, so that you can't afford it, right? At the end of the day, it's too much money, actual money that's spent on, you know, a bad candidate. So it's a big financial risk.
Switching angles a little bit, how do you approach hiring a development manager or hiring a people manager in general compared to hiring a developer?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think development managers, you want to know that someone is able to grow people, right? You want to know that someone has, in their past, worked with software developers and coached them. Provided learning opportunities for people, gotten them to the point where they can their teams can successfully prioritize, right, the work that needs to be done, and that they can successfully prioritize work that needs to be done. They're really good at communication up, down, and across, right, to stakeholders. So these are all things that I probe for. Like, are they strong communicators, right? At the end of the day, they have to talk to leadership. They have to talk to stakeholders. They have to talk to customers. They have to really like be able to give strong, you know, positive and negative feedback to team members. So I'm going to look for examples in their history that they've, you know, successfully communicated all of those kinds of things. And I'm going to look for, you know, people who are able to, you know, think strategically. Amazon, we always called it, you know, looking around the corner, right? Are you able to see a problem before it becomes a problem and head it off, right? Are you able to think about the business needs and translate those business needs into, you know, technical solutions. So these are things that sometimes, most of the time, you wouldn't expect an engineering team to do, like the mid-level junior engineers on the team. You'd occasionally expect a senior engineer to start thinking about them at the architecture level. But the development managers is really the one who, at the end of the day, is responsible for delivering the right solutions for the business. So they should be able to translate, you know, business requirements, work with product teams, work with, you know, external stakeholders, work with customers, and translate those things into here are actual physical, you know, concrete deliverables that my team is going to do. And now, like in, you know, kind of my position of running backend services and distributed systems, I want to see managers who have operational experience, right? I want to know that you're going to make the right call in the middle of an operational issue. You're going to talk through how do we roll back, you know, a bad deployment? How do we mitigate customer impact if something is happening to customers that isn't related to a deployment? So operationally, I want to know that someone's going to come in here and lead a team in the middle of a crisis to, you know, the best effect, right? So those are questions that I'm going to look for in a manager. So I think those are the kinds of things that I look for, right? For my roles, for my, you know, backend engineering roles.
Awesome. I think that's just really good tips there. If someone is trying to transition into a development manager from a senior SDE, what are some of your tips you have on things that they could brush up on and I guess focus on in terms of improving, making that transition to more of a people manager?
For software management roles, I think the thing you need to do is just establish that you're not in any way a risk around process understanding, first of all. Like, you should be able to, you know, especially in an agile shop, you should be able to run, you know, Scrum up, down, and sideways, right? You should, you know, not have any hesitation about what backlog grooming looks like, what retrospective looks like, any of that kind of stuff, right? Just the mechanics of doing software development you should have under your belt and kind of demonstrate that you're doing it, you know, week over week, month over month, consistently for a good enough period of time that there's no question that you'll be able to get it done as, you know, just, you know, a reflex once you're in the position. So I think that's the first thing to focus on. It's just good process development and understanding of development processes. I think the second thing is, you know, making sure that you can develop people, right? Even when you're not in a position to manage people directly, you can be a mentor, right? You can be a coach. You can be someone who helps other people, right? And guides them. And as an engineering manager who has transitioned engineers into management positions, the thing I look for and the thing that I try to encourage is, you know, can you provide concrete feedback to people who are developing software where I can review that, right? I can review your feedback, right? And that comes across most of the time in design reviews, architecture reviews, code reviews, right? Places where you can look at an artifact and say, you know, this other engineer guided someone else into making a better decision. And here's what they did. Here's how they guided that person. So I think if you're effectively doing that in a non-abrasive way, right, then you know, the team will typically recognize you as a leader, as someone who they would love to report to, or they would love to you know, have as a leader on the team. And that is maybe the strongest indication is, you know, are other people on the team supportive of you in that role? And you want to get that, you know, indication from other people. So if you're looking to make that transition, make sure you have support, right? Make sure you have people who have seen you do it and would be supportive of you doing it if the manager asked. I think those are the things that I would say, you know, work really well. It's a tough transition, right? It's not the same role. It's not a promotion. I think that's maybe one big misconception about going from individual contributor to management. It's a completely different job, right? It's definitely not a promotion, right? It's you have to be doing a completely different set of work and you have to prioritize your time completely differently. So you still need to keep your technical chops. You still need to be involved deeply as possible, but you have to kind of trade off time doing, you know, code reviews and design reviews sometimes for, you know, strategic thinking and strategic, you know, planning. That's just kind of the nature of it, right? So, you know, take the opportunities you get when you're an individual contributor to do those things and contribute in those ways if you can, and you'll kind of, you know, grow those muscles.
That sounds great. One thing I want to just kind of point on, and I was having this conversation recently with somebody else, and was around that promotion perspective, right? Where I think it's a failure of some companies' organizational structure, where a senior engineer has nowhere else to go but to become a manager, and you know, they don't have that principal or kind of more senior roles, and that's a very dangerous path for senior engineers to try to go and become a people manager suddenly if that's not what they're passionate about.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think different companies approach this problem differently. Microsoft has, you know, a million levels. So if you're a software engineer, you know, there's so many levels and you're constantly being promoted. At Amazon, there's three, right? There's junior, mid-level, and senior engineer. I think, what, 1% or maybe 2% of the engineering population in Amazon is principal. So it's, you know, really unrealistic that most engineers will get to that level. So promotions philosophically at Amazon are not the way to demonstrate career development. At Amazon, it's more about scope of responsibility. And I think I like that because unfortunately it means, you know, you're not going to see your title change and your level change, maybe forever, right? Once you get to a senior, you know, level. But you know, you'll be given more and more responsibility if you want it, right? I don't think there's ever a situation where, you know, someone says, I don't have enough to do, right? Once you're at that level, like, or really at any level, right? There's always more responsibility that you can give someone. And if they get to the point where they're really starting to do the kind of strategic cross-company impact, you know, projects and thinking and influence, then they'll sort of naturally get to the point where, yeah, okay, they're actually performing at a principal engineer level and they should be a principal engineer, not a senior engineer anymore. But, you know, if they don't go after that, those kinds of opportunities, if they don't establish that kind of, leadership and influence, then, you know, they'll stay a senior for as long as they want. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's fine. I think most people get to the point where they're, you know, they understand their area really, really deeply and really, really well. And that's what they're going to be doing. That's their scope. If you really, really, really want that extra scope, you have to work incredibly hard to get it. And then you can get to that next level, but that's not what Amazon considers career development. I think places like Amazon with very flat organizational structures consider career development to be scope of responsibility and scope of impact, not title.
Perfect. And on that note, we're almost at time here. If somebody wanted to get a hold of you, maybe find out more about kind of how they can improve their hiring processes, get some tips and advice, what's the best way they can get a hold of you?
Yeah. LinkedIn is probably the best way. I'd say LinkedIn, Sairam, my first name, LinkedIn/in/Sairam, I think is the way to find me. That's probably the easiest. I think I'm, you know, on other places, but I'd stick with LinkedIn.
Awesome. Sairam, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, it's great talking to you, man.